Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Jamal Abdi of the National Iranian American Council, who examines President Obama's rejection of a deal brokered by Brazil and Turkey to defuse the long-running international standoff over Iran's nuclear program. Rena Steinzer of the Center for Progressive Reform, who explains why she supports prosecuting Massey Coal Company CEO Don Blankenship for the deaths of 29 miners killed in the company's Upper Big Branch mine in April. And Chuck Collins of the Institute for Policy Studies, who assesses the recently passed Senate finance reform bills, strong points and shortcomings. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A year after the defeat of the Tamil Tiger insurgency in Sri Lanka, there are renewed calls for an international human rights investigation against the tactics used in the last days of the brutal 30-year civil war. Reports by the International Crisis Group and Human Rights Watch point to abuses committed by government soldiers against civilians in the final assault against the Tamil Tigers. The Brussels-based International Crisis Group lays out evidence that both the Sri Lankan military and Tamil Tiger fighters committed abuses against civilians, but the atrocities by the government were more severe. Allegations against Sri Lankan troops include intentionally shelling of civilians, hospitals and humanitarian operations. The United Nations estimates that in the final 4 months of the conflict, over 7,000 civilians were killed. The report also accused the Tamil Tiger rebel movement, which at one point controlled the northeast portion of Sri Lanka, with intentionally shooting civilians and preventing them from leaving the conflict zone. A year ago, Sri Lanka President Mahinda Rajapaksa promised UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon that the government would investigate war crimes. So far, no meaningful investigation has gotten underway. In 2007, Senator Barack Obama sponsored a bill to stop the Pentagon's practice of discharging injured soldiers for being diagnosed with a personality disorder, or PD, and deny wounded veterans disability benefits. Obama, along with Missouri Senator Kit Bond and California Senator Barbara Boxer, tried to stop the practice. The trio compromised and settled for an amendment calling on the Pentagon to investigate the dismissals for PD and report back to Congress. In early 2008, the Pentagon concluded no injured soldiers had been wrongly diagnosed with PD and none had been improperly discharged. According to The Nation magazine, the Pentagon did not review interviews with the soldiers discharged with PD, their families, doctors, or military commanders. Before leaving office, the Bush administration Under Secretary of Defense David Chu made a few minor changes in the program to protect soldiers. In recent months, Senators Kit Bond and Barbara Boxer have renewed their push to stop PD discharges, saying the current situation is appalling. In response, White House spokesperson Nicholas Shapiro says President Barack Obama remains concerned about the discharges but outlined no new action. Psychologist Troy Daniels observed, "The symptoms we are looking at here are more like traumatic brain injury or post-traumatic stress disorder. To take a soldier having problems with vision, hearing, and so forth, and say he has a personality disorder, that's a bogus kind of a statement." Faced with multiple cases of environmental abuses by British Petroleum, the Environmental Protection Agency has suspended negotiations over whether to bar the oil company from federal contracts in the Gulf of Mexico, which could cost BP billions of dollars. Since their oil platform exploded on April the 20th, BP has failed to stop the massive oil rupture from a deep underwater well that is now creating a massive oil slick that is polluting the shoreline of the Gulf Coast from Louisiana to Florida. According to ProPublica, the EPA issued a recent statement claiming that the agency is examining BP's overall record in the Gulf of Mexico, the frequency and patterns of incidents, its corporate culture, and recent changes in policies and procedures. The most severe type of sanction against BP is known as discretionary debarment, which would force BP to cancel its oil contracts with the Pentagon, as well as preventing BP from securing new oil leases or renewing its current oil leases with the federal government. The EPA's negotiations with BP were strained before the April destruction of the company's Deepwater Horizon oil rig. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
After years of confrontation between Washington, its allies, and Iran over the intentions of the Islamic Republic's nuclear program, Brazil and Turkey negotiated an agreement that they hoped would defuse the long-running standoff. Under the terms of the deal announced on May 17th, Iran would ship 2,640 pounds of its stockpile of low-enriched uranium to Turkey and receive in exchange more highly enriched uranium that would produce isotopes used in medical procedures. The higher-grade uranium from Russia and France would be used in an Iranian reactor under the supervision of the International Atomic Energy Agency. While Washington accuses Iran of developing the technology to produce nuclear weapons, the Iranian government maintains its nuclear program is intended for civilian generation of electric power. But the Obama administration has rejected the Brazilian-Turkey agreement, saying that Iran would be allowed to continue its enrichment program in violation of UN resolutions and retain control of enough uranium to make a nuclear bomb, something that was not the case under a similar deal proposed by Washington in October. Iran responded that it would walk away from the Brazilian-Turkish deal if the U.S. pursued new UN sanctions. President Obama is under pressure to get tough with Iran, given that Congress is poised to pass harsh sanctions of its own against Iran that could derail future U.S.-Iranian negotiations. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Jamal Abdi, policy director with the National Iranian American Council, who examines the consequences of President Obama's decision to reject the Brazilian-Turkish agreement with Iran on its uranium stockpile.
What you have here is Obama, when he came into office, he offered this outstretched hand to Iran. He said we were going to change directions as far as our policy towards Iran, and instead of going for a policy of pressure and zero engagement or limiting engagement, we were going to actually engage and try to have some robust diplomacy to resolve the issues that we have with Iran. So this all came to a head in October of last year when, for the first time in 30 years, the U.S. and Iran had negotiations. They actually sat down and attempted to work out some of the differences that exist. And what you had out of those that one meeting in October was this deal to transfer about 75% of Iran's low-enriched uranium out of the country. And the idea there was that this was going to build confidence because it was going to take enough of this uranium out of Iran that there wouldn't be enough material to build a bomb. And the idea was that this buys some time, you ease some of the tensions, you ease some of the pressure, and you allow for diplomacy to actually take place. It was an initial step. It was a confidence-building measure. Now, unfortunately, what happened was Iran agreed to that deal in principle on October 1st, and then a couple weeks later when they went to finalize the terms of the deal, Iran had some problems. They said, we don't want to ship the uranium out of the country. We want to keep it in Iran, but have it under IAEA monitors so we can't touch it. But we don't necessarily trust shipping it out of the country. Basically, the United States didn't accept that. They said, we need to have the uranium outside of the country in order to proceed. And you had this big standoff. Diplomacy was stalled, and a lot of the president's critics said diplomacy failed. So in the ensuing months, the administration shifted to the pressure track, and they worked to build a sanctions agreement with the other permanent representatives to the United Nations Security Council. And they've been doing that since about November. They've been discussing that. Well, last week, Brazil and Turkey actually brokered with Iran the deal that the U.S. had originally tried to stake. So on Monday, you had the leaders of Brazil, Turkey, and Iran saying, we finally got this deal, this confidence-building deal. We're going to have Iran ship its uranium out to Turkey, where it would be held in escrow, and this should be the opening for engagement.
Jamal, some of the objections raised by the Obama administration to the Turkey-Brazilian deal with Iran is that Iran allegedly has more enriched uranium on hand now in their country than they had when this deal was initially proposed back last October, so that even if they gave some of their enriched uranium over to Turkey under this negotiation, they would have enough uranium in Iran itself to theoretically create a nuclear weapon. In your view, is this a valid objection to this latest deal?
I don't think it's a valid objection to the deal. It's not worth killing the entire deal. It is a valid concern. However, it's actually not the case that Iran would have enough low-enriched uranium to theoretically make a bomb. Still, if they ship the 1,200 kilograms of LEU out of the country, they still have not quite enough to do that. And what this deal does, it does push back that amount of time when Iran would have the amount necessary to create a bomb. So it does buy a few months. However, we also have to keep in mind that all of the analysts, everybody, you know, the U.S. government has said that Iran does not have the capability to build a bomb today. If they decide to go forward with that, it would be 3 to 5 years. So we're talking about kind of a theoretical concept here of, in theory, they would have enough materials to, if they decided, build a bomb. To say we're going to scrap the entire deal because Iran, instead of turning over 75% of its LEU, they're only now going to turn over 55%. It kind of misses the principle that forms this whole deal. So I don't think it's a valid concern.
How concerned are you that the government of Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel will pursue their own airstrikes against Iranian nuclear laboratories and enrichment facilities that could set off a conflagration internationally?
Well, I'm very concerned that if that happened, it would set off a conflagration. That would be catastrophic. I don't know what the likelihood is of that. I know that that is a specter that has been kind of looming for a long time. Nobody thinks that that's going to do much good. I mean, at best, it's going to set the Iran nuclear program back a couple years. It will definitely do a lot of damage to the organic democratic movement within Iran. And, you know, it really could just be a situation that spirals out of control. There's not a lot of good prospects that come out of that. So I think that the mindset we need to be in Washington is to avoid a scenario where that's the only remaining option. And we have to do everything we can to figure out how to resolve this diplomatically. And if that includes sanctions, then fine, but it has to be sanctions as a tool that we use to achieve diplomacy, not a tool that we use in spite of diplomacy to get us closer to a military option.
That was Jamal Abdi, president of the National Iranian American Council. Contact the council at area code 202-386-6325 or visit their website at niacouncil.org. The worst mining disaster in 40 years took place at a mine owned by Massey Energy in southern West Virginia, where 29 miners were killed on April 5th. In just the past 4 years, Massey has been cited for more than 500 health and safety violations in its mines by federal inspectors, who also stated that 90 of them were deemed significant and due to the company's reckless disregard for the safety of its workers. Under CEO Don Blankenship, Massey has challenged almost every single violation, delaying implementation of necessary changes. In the wake of the Massey mine explosion, the Obama administration has launched a civil investigation to better understand what happened and to put in place procedures to prevent a repeat of similar disasters in the future. The FBI is also conducting a criminal investigation. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Rena Steinzer, a professor at the University of Maryland Law School and president of the Center for Progressive Reform, a virtual think tank of 50 experts around the country who focus on issues of the environment, health, and safety. She explains the precedents for holding company executives criminally liable in fatal accidents and why she supports prosecuting Don Blankenship personally for the deaths of the West Virginia miners.
A criminal investigation of a mining disaster is relatively unusual. This company, Massey Energy, was investigated in the past at Arakoma, and as I understand it, they were fined. But that's the company, not the people, the individuals. I think there is far too little criminal prosecution of executives. And that was that's a point that I've been making as often as I can.
Can you talk a little bit about the circumstances under which an executive of a company could be held criminally liable for a fatal accident, such as the one that occurred at the Upper Big Branch Mine?
In the health, safety, and environment area, there is a doctrine that was created by the Supreme Court. It's called the Responsible Corporate Officer Doctrine. And it says, in essence, if you're in a position in a company to do something about a problem that is very dangerous, that could cause either extensive damage to the environment or hurt people, then you can be held criminally liable, even if you didn't carry out the activities that caused the problem yourself. If you were in a position to avoid or prevent the problem, you're criminally liable. And that's a doctrine that is not used often enough.
Rena Steinzer, do you know of any examples where the head of a company was held criminally liable and maybe spent any time in prison?
First of all, the two Supreme Court cases that I was discussing, one involved shipment of adulterated drugs. That was back in 1943. The second involved rodent infestation of a food warehouse. There also was a case in Maryland where civilian employees at the Aberdeen Proving Grounds buried hazardous waste on the Army property, and they were prosecuted criminally and did serve brief jail terms, I believe.
Since the accident, we've all heard how Massey Energy, under Don Blankenship's leadership, has been cited for hundreds of serious health and safety violations. Do you think he's a good candidate for criminal prosecution?
Yes, I think Blankenship is a very good candidate for criminal prosecution because he created a culture where workers were afraid that they would be fired if they paid attention to safety precautions. The mine was evacuated several times before the fatal explosion, and yet Blankenship refused, despite this obvious indication that something was seriously wrong. He refused to address these problems. As you mentioned, he was cited hundreds, thousands, if you go back far enough times, for serious violations, serious problems, and fought every single one of them. This is not a company under his leadership, and he was personally involved in a lot of these episodes, that had demonstrated any concern for worker safety. And in my view, if you don't prosecute chief executive officers in those circumstances, you dilute the message and you create a circumstance where the company will be given a monetary fine and will go back to its bad old ways, because too often the fine is not even the amount that they saved by violating the law.
The FBI is doing the criminal investigation, but Joe Maine, the new head of MSHA, the Mine Safety and Health Administration, is also investigating the accident for the Obama administration. What kind of job do you think he's doing?
I think Joe Maine is trying to make the best use he can of the resources that he has, but MSHA is painfully underfunded and has survived in a culture where the career people are badgered and dissuaded from doing an aggressive job. Too often we find that career civil servants have sort of a muscle memory of the Bush administration, and it takes a lot of aggressive leadership to change that perception. And I think that the Obama appointees in these top jobs are trying very hard to change that culture. Unfortunately, they haven't yet received enough money to give their agencies the kind of muscle that they need. And we're not talking about huge sums. We're talking about even tens of millions of dollars, which is a very small amount in comparison to the harm that's caused by these incidents, would make them much more present. They'd have more inspectors. They'd be more aggressive. They'd have better lawyers. And they would clean up this industry a lot quicker.
That was Rena Steinzer of the Center for Progressive Reform. Contact the center at area code 410-706-0564. or visit the group's website at progressivereform.org. The U.S. Senate passed a finance reform bill on May 20th, joining the House, which passed its own legislation in December, in response to the abuses of Wall Street firms and the nation's largest banks that triggered the worst economic crisis in the U.S. since the Great Depression. While America's largest financial institutions employed an army of lobbyists and spent millions of dollars in an attempt to weaken regulations in the Senate bill, they seem relieved that the legislation, passed by a 59-39 vote, did not adopt stronger regulations or mandate more fundamental changes to the current system. In fact, the day after the Senate passed the bill, bank stocks soared. The Senate legislation creates a new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, regulates the financial derivatives market, establishes a Financial Stability Oversight Council of regulators that would work to identify systemic risks, and sets up new procedures for liquidating failed financial firms. Progressive activists were disappointed that the Senate rejected an amendment by Democratic Senators Sherrod Brown of Ohio and Ted Kaufman of Delaware that would have broken up some of the biggest banks to limit the risks that these too-big-to-fail institutions pose to the financial system. There was also frustration that the legislation retained some dangerous loopholes in derivatives trading. Congressional leaders hope to hammer out differences between the House and Senate bills and take a final vote before the 4th of July recess. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Chuck Collins, director of the Institute for Policy Studies Program on Inequality and Common Good. Here, Collins assesses the Senate reform legislation's strong points and shortcomings, expressing hope that activists will continue to work hard to strengthen the bill before it's signed into law.
I think that, you know, it is the biggest reform of the financial sector since the Great Depression of the 1930s. I think it's overall positive. It's way better than if nothing had happened. It does provide new oversight, new tools, if you will, to kind of rein in financial excess. And I would say that the good elements are that it does, for the first time, regulate derivatives, the unregulated betting, gambling instruments that are in what I would call the sort of unregulated shadow banking system. It prohibits, at least the Senate version, will prohibit banks from trading derivatives. Both bills have some requirements on banks that they keep a little more money on hand in terms of reserves against future losses. The House passed a bill. The Senate just passed this bill. Between now and the 4th of July, there's going to be a conference committee that's going to reconcile the differences between the two bills, and then it'll come back for a final vote and a signing by President Obama.
I know that there were many progressives around the country who were disappointed that the effort of a couple of senators to institute a circuit breaker on too big to fail by breaking up the largest banks in the country, that amendment really went nowhere. Maybe you could talk about that for a moment and any other elements that really should have been part of this bill.
Yeah, well, that's a big one. And I was part of a coalition pressing for this, essentially a provision, we call it, you know, as you call it, too big to fail. And it was sponsored by Senator Sherrod Brown and Ted Kaufman from Delaware, who's the only senator who doesn't have to raise money for re-election. So he's incredibly independent and outspoken. Did get 39 votes, not enough to pass, but it would have essentially created a process whereby banks that were just too big, these large six or seven huge banks, it would have created an orderly process for requiring them to spin off and shrink and decentralize some of their assets. And I think that was exciting because initially there wasn't any thought that it even would get on the floor and that there would be a debate and we would be able to sort of track who backed it and who didn't. But that's part of the unfinished business that I think we'll have to come back and address. You know, the other problems are I would hope that there would be an independent Consumer Financial Protection Agency as the House bill included. One of the problems is that the financial sector is so powerful in terms of its lobbying resources that it tends to capture, control the regulatory agencies that watch them. There's unfortunately still a lot of loopholes in the regulation of derivatives, and these are, you know, very sophisticated investment instruments, and already some people in the financial sector are trying to create new instruments to kind of work around whatever regulations come along. So there's just going to have to be kind of a robust oversight agency to do that. In other ways, that it doesn't address maybe the deepest problems of the financial sector, which is this really over the last 20 years, this tremendous concentration of wealth and power in the hands of a few institutions. It doesn't really clean up the Federal Reserve. It creates the beginning of an accountability structure, but it doesn't sort of deal with the fact that, as Gillian Tett in her book about Wall Street says, that finance has become the master, not the servant, of the productive economy. So there's still these sort of larger economic and political issues about how much power has concentrated in the financial sector to the detriment of Main Street and the real economy. So I think that this bill does some good things, but it doesn't sort of address in some ways the biggest challenge that we still face.
Well, Chuck, as an organizer yourself, veteran of many campaigns on financial and income inequality issues, were you happy with the activism out there in the country to press Congress to really rein in the abuses of Wall Street? It seems like there's certainly a larger constituency out in the country that would have really, you know, called for major overhaul of our system that didn't occur. And is there still a chance, you think, that people could mobilize to really push hard at Congress to make sure that a final bill that comes out of this will really do the job?
Well, there was some impressive organizing. It was all maybe a little too late to build a countervailing power to Wall Street, but it was impressive nonetheless. And as I monitor things just in the last couple of days, it seems like people are committed to kind of sticking with the progressive reform agenda and continuing to work on that. But it is sobering to look at the power of the financial sector right now. And that's the big challenge, is how do we challenge this concentration of wealth and power and use this populist moment, the fact that many people see the big sections of Wall Street aren't really doing anything productive, aren't really serving any wider social good in terms of providing capital for the real economy, that a lot of this is about gambling and squeezing more value out of the real economy and funneling it up the economic ladder to the very wealthy. And so we have this moment. We have the Tea Party and the Ron Paul libertarians and the progressives all have some common cause here, and hopefully we can make the most out of that.
That was Chuck Collins, director of the Institute for Policy Studies Program on Inequality and Common Good. Contact the group by calling area code 202-234-9382 or visit their website at ips-dc.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Indu Anand, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.